Welcome to episode 2 of The Distance Between Stars, a sci-fi novelette and audio drama by Stephen Cavett. Stick around after the show for fun facts and a look at what's next. Enjoy the show.
Some nights, we'd lie on a blanket in the grass and watch the stars with my father's arms around us. Layla and I would doze off, and Dag would pull us close against his canvas jacket, his eyes open to the sky. When I woke, I'd look for Orion striding across the treetops toward the glow of town. I could tell how long I'd slept by how far he had traveled in the night. Part god, impossibly handsome, Orion was the world's first trophy hunter. He tore across the forests of ancient Greece, threatening to kill every wild thing. No one knows which god created the giant scorpion to stop him. Maybe it was Gaia, the grieving Earth Mother. Maybe Artemis, goddess of the hunt. But it was Zeus who stopped the hunter and scorpion from killing each other. He flung Orion and Scorpio to opposite ends of the sky, where they chase each other across the horizon for eternity. That was the first story my dad told us about Orion, the zigzag constellation of winter nights. He didn't tell us the others until later, when he thought we'd need them. The first wave hit southern Mexico in mid-April, when the surfers and Volkswagen vans had just begun to crowd the streets of Puerto Escondido. Cell towers went down, and no videos made it out. Blackouts rolled north into the Yucatan Peninsula and the coffee plantations of Oaxaca. When the UND finally reached Mexico City, mangled bodies and burning buildings dominated the feeds, and the grid went down. We thought it was an earthquake, or the cartels. Then Russia was in a shooting war, and the president went on air from a bunker with a stage set of the White House behind him. "First contact," he said. Intentions unclear. God bless the United States of America and the world. American tanks rolled across the Alaskan highway through Canada. The Navy streamed up the West Coast. The news from Russia sounded like Star Trek mixed with Beowulf. Monsters and cloaked ships. Vulnerabilities unknown. "Get home now," my father said. "Drive all night before the gas is gone." As a child, I loved Orion because it was so easy to find the three stars of his belt, then his shoulders and his feet. I loved how his hunting dog, Canis Major, followed at his heels, his eye the brightest star in the sky. I imagined Orion like my father, an outdoorsman with flannel, strong arms, and stubble. Who wouldn't love a man who showed up night after night? I didn't know the other stories until I was a teen. How Orion raped Princess Merope, how he harassed the Virgin Pleiades so long the gods whisked them into the sky for safekeeping. How Venus seduced him in a cave and vanished. Love blind, Orion stepped into the dazzling sunlight, confused his sister for the goddess, and slept with her instead. This other Orion was the kind of asshole I would meet in frat parties and college bars. The Hollywood creeps who looked me up and down on the street. The finance bros on dating apps who offered sex instead of dinner. The wrong man, so charming, the virgin Artemis fell for him until her brother intervened. If we're living in the old stories, I don't know which character the fleet is. The defenseless Pleiades, transformed into doves to escape? The boy who hunted to feed the gods before he turned mean? The sexual predator? The killer chased by a monster but ready to fight? The universe was a rough place long before the Und. My father's stories taught me that. There are so few places to lie warm with strong arms around you and the smell of wood smoke and old spice. Space is mostly empty, and we fill it with our fears and our dreams.
I don't look people in the eyes. That's one thing. If you want to talk about how it changed me, how it changed all of us, Earth is gone. Maybe there still are some pine cones under the scorched soil, or seeds in some bunker in Nebraska, but they'll grow in twisted and weird after the blast. I've read the reports. No one's going back there unless the Und come looking for the ones we killed. I hope they do. I hope they breathe the fallout. Sorry, I'm always tapping something. That's another. My fingers on the mess hall table. My sneakers on the floor during briefing. A number two pencil against my leg while I wait for the commander to dictate another speech about perseverance. He loves that word. We must persevere. All night, I tap my chewed fingernails against the metal webbing of the bunk bed above me, while my roommate, Rachel Downs, whose hair has perfect curls and 3/4 gravity, tries to sleep. Oh, my name is Amelia Shizeski. Was I supposed to say that at the beginning? Trauma gets in your DNA and you pass it down to your grandkids. That's what Sam says. Any kids we have will be messed up. And these little kids right now, the space rats, there aren't enough therapists left to help them. Scratch City had packs of 8 and 9-year-olds with screwdrivers under their shirts, robbing old women, when there were still old women left to rob. One of these little shits is probably going to open the airlocks and vent us all. Soldiers don't think about birth control in the apocalypse. Filling the bulkhead with condoms wasn't a big priority when they were packing beans and rice and morphine. So Sam and I tried pulling out like everyone else. The goddess method, my friend Alele calls it. She's one of those rainbow yoga chicks who chant in lotus pose in Rec Hall 6. We shouldn't risk it, Sam always whispers under the thin gray blanket, while Rachel whimpers above us in her sleep. It's not worth bringing kids into this mess. I nod, but then I scratch my nails across the back of his neck like he likes, and squeezed my legs around his waist. What's the alternative? Drift through the darkness with no one to hold? Take up space knitting? You can only run on the treadmill with weights around your ankles for so long. People fuck in the good times, but they really get down when they might die any minute. It was that way in the tent cities, too. If you were hungry, if you needed shoes, supplies were easy to come by if you knew how to ask. So yeah, I don't look people in the eyes. Especially Sam. Especially when we make love. I know the things I've done.
The Davy Jones is wild, man. They picked up a crew of roughnecks who hauled down an oil rig off the coast of Texas for 2 years. They started with pipe wrenches and Molotov cocktails. By the end, they had M4s and a couple dozen illegal kids they found hiding in a church basement. Ferried them over on Zodiacs with their faces blacked out. Hid them under space blankets to cut down on the thermals. We lost most of the West those 2 years. Those guys were fishing the Gulf of Mexico and running patrols on jet skis. Bettles said they had a room full of unskulls, but I don't know. That rig is ashes now. Those rig hands hit hard when they're drinking. I know that. When I was stationed on the Davy, we'd move everybody else out of the way and pull the tables back and let them pound. We need men like that when we get where we're going. Men who can take a hit. Wherever we land, it's going to hit back hard. The Dakota's pretty chill, though. I've been here a few months. It's mostly admins and space nerds. We get some noise complaints. Petty theft. Usually just engineers forgetting where they left their laptops. Most days, we move boxes and paint panels, and work out so we don't get soft in partial grav. Nobody talks about it, but it's boring after the war. We're out there lighting up space fucks, and now we're hanging LEDs, you know? My guys drive fire on Saturdays. We triple check the empty rifles, stick the chamber flags in, and then we practice clearing the gym. Evans and me drew targets and hostages on cardboard strips so the guys don't forget how to think. Bound cover to cover in ship grav. Dip the sights past the friendlies and find the whispers. Click the empty chambers. Drop the mag and slam another home. Your hands remember better than your brain. Got a few hundred thousand rounds in the armory. Enough for a siege. If the UN catch us, my guys still know how to shoot. But the metalheads had a long time to get used to space. We've been out here, what, a year? I don't even know if we'd see them coming.
I owned a Cessna 150 when I lived in Miami. A puddle jumper from the 60s with faded orange paint. I got it used from a flight school in Boca. Single engine, twin seats, barely room for an overnight bag. A minivan could outrun you in a headwind. But dating with it was a piece of cake. You try asking a woman to fly to the Bahamas for dinner and see what happens. Best 16 grand I ever spent. A Chesterfield is no Cessna, I'll tell you that. I've been studying the manuals on my tablet at night I'm going to fly this crate. I've got to understand it. I'm going to get some of the physics wrong here, but this thing is a work of art. The main problem with space is the distance between stars. 4.37 light years to Alpha Centauri. That's 6,000 years if we burn rocket fuel, but the weight of the fuel would tear the ship apart. Tsiolkovsky's equation proves interstellar flight is impossible with combustion engines. Plus, 6,000 years ago, we were taming chickens in Mesopotamia and building stone temples. 6,000 years in space, who knows what would step off the ships. Scientists have been trying to develop interstellar probes since the 1970s. Even Stephen Hawking was planning one when he died. A stamp-sized ship with solar sails. It was all theoretical at first. Optimists with PhDs and pocket protectors. Then the UN hit, and space programs went into overdrive. Startups and labs around the world tested blueprints and equipment. NASA ran point, directing video calls and discussion boards. Took them 5 years, and only two teams blew themselves up. Not bad for a bunch of apes who'd only walked on the moon a few times. The answer is a direct fusion drive. Smash two nuclei together to make one fat one. Burn the leftover energy. Shield the squishy payload. That's us. Invent the radiation into space. Keep the other ships clear of the exhaust, and you're in the Goldilocks zone in 200 years. The Thomas drives a 30-foot cylinder of charged gases wrapped in electromagnetic coils. Liquid metal walls keep us safe from the bad stuff. We pump extra gases in to create ship thrust. You can even run the ship's electrics off it. It's lightning in a bottle, basically. Split atoms apart, you get Hiroshima. Fuse them together, you get spaceflight. We started out with boosters bolted to the ship and jettisoned them when we cleared the planet. They're still floating in our solar system. Little middle fingers pointed at the UND. I don't want to say the metalheads were good for us. But if they hadn't landed, we'd still be dragging our feet on the Mars colony. Now I'm flying a nuclear ship with laser cannons at 44,000 kilometers a second. My mother would have said the Lord moves in mysterious ways. My father would have rolled his eyes. Me? I don't know what to believe. I just fly the ship. If we make it, the kids can figure out the rest.
Thanks for listening to Chapter 2 of The Distance Between Stars, a sci-fi novelette and audio drama by me, Stephen Cabot. Today's episode featured Kaylee Weintraub as intrepid journalist Nikish Fromer, Brittany Ruthier as Fleet Secretary Amelia Shizeski, John Lofton as underemployed Marine Sam Wale, Dr. Joe Flowers as accidental pilot Alan Abernathy, and our amazing sound editor, John Cornelius. Nikish says something in this episode that's true for me, too. I love the constellation Orion. Growing up in Tennessee, I backpacked and slept out in the backfield behind the house a lot. And I'd wake up in the middle of the night and look for Orion, just so I knew what time it was. He's one of those steady presences, bright enough to see just about anywhere I've traveled. I knew his basic story from teaching environmental ed to school kids in the Appalachians, but researching him for this project was a bit of a shock. I think that's how the old myths are supposed to be. They're never black and white. They're always a little dangerous. They're always true to life. We've got 3 episodes left of The Distance Between Stars. On the Stephen Cabot Presents podcast, you get the whole book for free. I won't hide the last chapter behind a paywall. I'm not going to stop you from buying a copy either. It's available now on Kindle Unlimited and in print at major booksellers. We've got a link in the episode description. Join my mailing list at stephencabot.com for a heads up about the next book, The Uncertainty Principle, as jump tech Snap Arbuckle Jr. tries to rescue the only girl he almost loved from a space-time anomaly and the vicious aliens known as the Und.